The arrow struck him in the throat, and the point ran through the soft neck. He sank to the other side, and the goblet dropped from his hands. In an instant, a thick jet of blood spouted from his nostrils. He pushed the table away with a quick jerk of his feet, spilling all the victuals on the ground, meat and bread in a mess. Then there was a great uproar all through the place as they saw the man fall. They leapt up from their seats in excitement and looked all round at the walls, but there was neither shield nor spear to be seen. They shouted angrily at Odysseus, "You shall pay for shooting a man! No more games for you! Now your death is a safe thing! You have killed the best fellow in Ithaca, and so the vulture shall eat you here!" They were just guessing. They never dreamt that he intended to kill the man. Poor fools! They did not know that the cords of death were made fast about them all. But Odysseus said with a frowning face, "Dogs! You thought I would never come back from Troy, so you have been carving up my substance, forcing the women to lie with you, courting my wife before I was dead, not fearing the gods who rule the broad heavens, nor the execration of man which follows you forever. And now the cords of death are made fast about you all." Then pale fear seized upon them. Eurymachus alone dared to answer, "If you are really Ithacan Odysseus, come back. What you have said is just and right. Plenty of wild doings here, plenty more on your farms. But there lies the guilty man, Antinous, who is answerable for everything. He was the ringleader. A wife was not what he wanted, not so much as something else which Cronion has not allowed him to do. He wished to murder your son by a secret assault, and to be sole lord and master in this fine country of Ithaca. Now he has his deserts and lies dead. Sir, spare your own people. We will make it all good. All that has been consumed, all the wine that has been drunk in this hall, there shall be a public collection, and each man severally will pay 20 oxen in compensation, and bring gold and bronze to your heart's content. Till that is done, no one could blame you for being angry." Odysseus answered with a frowning face, "Eurymachus, not if you would give me your whole estates, all you now possess, and more if you could get it. Not even so would I stay my hand from killing until every man of you shall have paid in full for his outrageous violence. Now, the choice lies before you, fight or flight, if you wish to save your lives. But I do not think any one of you will escape sudden death." As they listened, their knees gave way beneath them, and despair entered their hearts. But Eurymachus once more spoke. "My friends," he cried out, "this man will not hold his hands. He thinks he is invincible. He has bow and arrows, and he will shoot from the doorway until he has killed us all. Let us fight for it. Draw your swords and pull up the tables to fend off his arrows. Have at him all together. See if we can't push him away from the door and get out and make a hue and cry in the town. Then this man will soon shoot his last shot." With this, he drew a good sharp blade from his side and leapt at Odysseus with a yell. But on the instant, Odysseus let fly an arrow and struck him in the chest by the nipple. The sharp point pierced his liver. Down fell the sword from his hand. He doubled up and fell sprawling over a table. Victuals and cup went scattering over the floor. He beat his brow on the ground in agony. His feet kicked out and knocked over the chair, and a mist came over his eyes. Then Amphinomus ran straight at Odysseus, sword in hand, to force his way out of the door. But Telemachus was too quick for him. He cast his spear from behind and struck him between the shoulders. The point came out through his chest, and his face crashed on the ground with a thud. Telemachus leapt back and left the spear in the body. He feared that someone might stab him with a sword or strike a blow if he stooped to pull it out. He ran quickly up to his father and said, without wasting words, "Father, I'll go at once and fetch you a shield and a couple of spears and a helmet to fit your head, and I'll arm myself, and do the same for the drover and the swineherd. We ought to be armed." Odysseus answered, "Run and bring them while I have arrows left, or they may crowd me away from the door." Telemachus went promptly to the store where the arms were kept. He chose 4 shields and 8 spears and 4 good helmets of bronze with horsehair plumes. These he brought back at full speed to his father. First he armed himself, then the 2 men fitted themselves out, and they stood by the indomitable Odysseus. As long as the arrows lasted, Odysseus went on, bringing them down one after another. But when the arrows came to an end and he could shoot no more, he leaned his bow on the doorpost and left it standing, then slung the stout shield over his shoulders and fitted the helmet on his head where the nodding plume seemed to threaten those who saw it. Lastly, he picked up two sharp-pointed spears. But there was a door high up in the wall, closed by a strong pair of leaves. At the top of the steps, the way led through into a passage on the other side. Odysseus had told the swineherd to stand near this door and to keep an eye on it. There was only one way to get there. Now, Agelaus had thought of this, and he called out, "I say, friends, couldn't someone go up to that door and publish the news and set up a hue and cry on the spot? This man would soon shoot his last shot." Melanthius the goatherd answered, "Impossible, my lord. The courtyard gate is terrible near, and the passage mouth is dangerous. One strong man could easily hold it against many. But look here, I can fetch you arms from the storehouse. I am sure Odysseus and his son put them away there and nowhere else." Then Melanthius ran up and through the back ways of the house into the storeroom and collected a dozen shields and as many spears and good strong helmets. Back he came quickly with them and distributed them. When Odysseus saw the men arming themselves and poising the spears, he was quite taken aback. He saw a new danger, so he called out to Telemachus without wasting words. "Telemachus, I'm sure one of the women inside is helping these fellows against us, or else it's Melanthius, that's what I think." Telemachus said,
"Oh, father, it is my fault. No one else is to blame. I left the door of the storeroom open, and they had a better scout than I was.
Eumaeus, man, go and shut that door and see if one of the women is doing this or Melanthius tricks son, like father, like son."
While they were talking, Melanthius went on a second journey for arms, but Eumaeus saw him this time and said to Odysseus at his elbow,
"Look here, my beloved lord and master, the man we guessed at has disappeared again, going to the storehouse. Tell me what to do. Shall I kill him, if I can, or bring him here? And then we can pay him out for his evil doings in thy house."
Odysseus answered, "I and my son can manage to hold off the worst they can do here. You two just twist his hands and feet behind him, and tie them to a couple of planks, fasten him to a stout rope, and haul him up the pillar to the roof beams, and leave him there. Let him live and see how he likes it." They listened attentively and did what he told them. To the storeroom they went. The man was inside hunting for weapons, but he did not hear them. They stood one on each side of the door, and as he came out, carrying a helmet in one hand and an old broad shield in the other, it was one which Laertes had carried in his young days, covered with mould and dirt, which lay there with all the seams bursting, they pounced upon him and caught him, dragged him in by the hair, threw him on the ground in a great state, twisted his hands and feet behind him, and trussed him up in a very uncomfortable package according to directions, twisted a rope round him, and hauled him right up the pillar to the roof beams. There you had your revenge, friend Eumaeus, for you said pleasantly, "Now you shall watch all night long, Melanthius, with a soft bed to lie on, as you richly deserve, and you shall not fail to see dawn when she shall appear through the misty air out of the ocean, upon her golden throne, at the time when you drive your goats down for the gentleman's dinner." There they left him, strung up in that dreadful bundle. The two put on their armor again, shutting the door, and returned to Odysseus. There they all stood, breathing fury. In the doorway, four. Within the hall, many, and good men, too. But now Athena came near to them in the likeness of Mentor. Odysseus was cheered by the sight. He guessed it was Athena, captain of hosts. But he said to her,
"Mentor, stand by me and remember your old comrade who always did the right thing by you. We are years mates."
Then the others raised a loud shout in the hall, and Agelaus Demastorides called out threateningly,
"Mentor, don't let Odysseus cajole you to fight on his side against us. If you do, I promise you that when we have settled father and son, we will kill you too. You will pay with your life for what you mean to do. We will wipe out your people if they try to avenge you, and seize your goods indoors and out, and throw them in with the rest. Your sons and daughters shall not live in your house. Your worthy wife shall not walk in the town of Ithaca."
Athena grew hot with anger at this, and taunted Odysseus with angry words. You are not the man you were, Odysseus. Where is the courage and strength you showed in that endless conflict, those 9 years of battles for beautiful Helen? Many a man you killed in open fight, and by your device the great city of Priam was taken. Now you have come back to hearth and home. Why do you grumble to show your strength before a pack of young men in love? Lazy man, stand by my side and see a masterpiece. I will teach you in the face of the enemy what means the gratitude of mentor strong the arm.
But she did not give him overwhelming victory at once, for she wished to prove still further the strength and courage of Odysseus and his doughty son. In the shape of a swallow, she flew up to the smoky rafters and perched there. The invaders were now led by 6 men. Agelaus, Eurynomus, Amphimedon, Demoptolemus, Pausandrus, and Polybus. They were the best of those who still lived, and they were fighting for their lives. The rest had been brought down or cowed by the arrows flying thick and fast. Agelaus addressed himself to the whole body. "My friends, now the man will slacken his invincible hands. You see how Mentor went off after a few empty boasts and left them alone there by the door? Now then, don't all throw your spears at once, but let 6 of us first give a volley, and see if Zeus will grant us to strike down Odysseus and cover ourselves with glory. Never mind the rest once he shall fall." So the 6 volleyed eagerly, but Athena made them all miss. One spear hit the doorpost, one a leaf of the door, a third fell heavily and stuck in the wall. They dodged the others, and Odysseus gave orders in his turn. "Now, my friends, when I give the word, let fly at this crowd who are determined to destroy us after all their unprovoked injuries." At the word, they all took aim and volleyed. Odysseus hit Demoptolemus, Telemachus, Euryades, the swineherd, Elatus, and the drover, Pisandros. All fell together and bit the dust, and the others took refuge at the far end of the hall. The 4 advanced and drew their spears out of the bodies. Another volley came from the crowd in fury, but Athena made most of them miss. One stuck in the doorpost, one in the door, and a third fell heavily against the wall. However, at last Amphimedon grazed the wrist of Telemachus, cutting the skin, and Ctesippus with his long spear grazed the shoulder of Eumaeus over the shield, but the spear passed on and fell to the ground. Then Odysseus and his party volleyed again into the throng. Odysseus hit Eurydamas, Telemachus, Amphimedon, the swineherd Polybus. Lastly, the drover hit Ctesippus full in the chest and shouted in triumph, "One for you, old braggart son, with your foul tongue! Learn not to boast like a fool, but leave the word to the gods, for they are mightier far. Here's a little tip for you in return for that hoof which you threw at my master Odysseus when he was begging in the hall." Not bad for a drover of horned cattle. Then they came to close fighting. Odysseus wounded Demasterides with a spear thrust. Telemachus struck Leocritus, running him through the groin and out at the other side, and he fell flat on his face. At that moment, Athena lifted her man-shattering aegis cape and held it against them from on high. They fell into a panic and scampered along the hall like a herd of cows when the darting gadfly attacks them and scatters them in the long days of springtime. The 4 were after them like vultures that swoop down out of the mountains with curving beaks and hooked claws on a flock of birds. Hide as they will, flying low under the clouds, the vultures are on them, a pounce and a kill. There is no help and no refuge, and the onlookers think it fine sport. So these 4 rushed upon their enemies, spearing men right and left. To every blow a dreadful groan, and the ground ran with blood. But Leodes ran up to Odysseus and threw his arms round his knees, begging for his life in plain words, without ceremony. "Spare me, Odysseus, I pray. Have mercy upon me. I declare that I never meddled with the women in this house, by word or deed. No, I tried to stop the others when they did anything of that sort, but they would not listen to me and keep their hands from evil, and so their own recklessness has brought them to a dreadful end. But I am only their diviner. I have done nothing, and I am to die because there is no gratitude in the world for good deeds done."
Odysseus said to him, frowning, "If you call yourself their diviner, you must have prayed often enough that I might never be so happy as to return home, that my beloved wife might go with you and bear your children. Therefore you shall not escape the terror of death.
He picked up the sword which Agelaus had dropped when he was struck down, and drove it through the man's throat. Even while he was speaking, his head rolled in the dust. But the minstrel had escaped death so far. This was Phemius Terpiades, the tuneful son of harmony, as his name denotes, but he had been dragged in by compulsion to sing for the roistering crew. He was standing close to the back door, harp in hand, hesitating whether to run out of the hall and take refuge at the great altar of Zeus built in the courtyard, where both Laertes and Odysseus used to sacrifice, or to run up and clasp the knees of Odysseus, Laertes' son. He thought it better to throw himself on the mercy of Odysseus, so he set down his harp on the ground between the mixing bowl and the seat of state, and running quickly clasped the master's knees, and besought him in plain and simple words, "Spare me, Odysseus, I pray. Have mercy upon me. You will be sorry afterwards if you kill a singer like me, one who can sing before God and man. I am self-taught, but God has planted all manner of songs in my mind. I am fit to sing before you as before God. Then do not be eager to cut my throat. Your own son Telemachus can tell you that no will of my own made me come into this house, no desire for gain. I had to sing to these men at supper because they were too many for me and too strong, because they compelled me."
Telemachus was close by his father and heard this. He said at once, "Spare him, father. He is innocent. Don't strike him. And let us spare Medon, the marshal, who used to look after me here when I was a little boy. Unless Philetius or the swineherd has killed him, or he may have come in your way as you went raging through the hall." Medon heard him. He was there, smart lad, huddled under a chair, rolled up in a new flayed cowhide, where he had crawled to escape if he could. Now he was out with one leap from under the chair, threw off the hide, dashed up to Telemachus, grasped his knees, cried out simply,
"Here I am, my dear. Spare me, sir. Tell the master not to hurt me with that sharp sword. He's almighty now. And those brutes, no wonder, was angry with him, devouring his goods in his own house, and thought nothing of thee, like the fools they were."
Odysseus smiled and said, "Cheer up. My son has saved your life. So you shall know, and tell other men, that doing well is far better than doing ill. Now then, you two had better go out of this carnage into the yard and stay there until I have finished what is left for me to do in this house."
They both went out and sat down by the altar of Zeus, gazing about them, and every moment expecting death.
Odysseus looked carefully in every part of the hall, in case anyone were still alive and hiding himself from death. But he saw them all lying in heaps, amid blood and dust. They were like a great haul of fishes, which the fishermen have drawn into a bay with a wide net. They lie on the sand, panting for the salt water, while the blazing sun takes away their life. Then at last Odysseus said to Telemachus, "Go and call Nurse Eurycleia. I have something I want to tell her."
Telemachus went to the women's room and, shaking the door, called Eurycleia. "Wake up now, grandam wife. Wake up, keeper of all the women in this great house. Come this way. My father calls you. He has something which he wants to tell you."
She had no notion what he meant, but she opened the door and followed him. There she found Odysseus smothered in blood and filth, cheeks and chest, from head to foot, with a terrible look on his face, like a lion which has just chawed up a bullock in the farmyard. When she saw the piles of dead bodies and streams of blood, she stretched her body for the women's alleluia at this great victory. But Odysseus checked her and stopped it, not without difficulty, as he said plainly, "Keep your joy in your heart, woman. Quiet now, no cries of triumph. It is not decent to boast over slain men. These have been brought low by God's decree and their own wicked deeds. They respected none of those who walk on the earth, neither good men nor bad. Therefore their recklessness has brought them to a dreadful end. Now, tell over the names of the women in this house, and say which disgrace me and which are innocent."
The old nurse answered,
"Aye, my love, I'll tell thee the truth of it. 50 women there are in this house. We have taught them all their work to card wool and to put up with what a slave must bear. 12 of them are shameless hussies, and pay no respect to me or my lady herself. The young master has but now grown up, and the mistress wouldn't let him give orders to the women, but I'll just go up the stairs and tell her the news. She's having a bit of sleep, thank God.
Odysseus answered, Don't wake her yet. Tell all the women to come here who have been disgracing themselves. Then the old woman went out of the hall to summon the women at once. He called Telemachus and the drover and swineherd and told them plainly what they had to do. The first thing is to carry out these bodies and tell the women to help you. Then wipe clean all the chairs and tables with sponge and water. When you have put the place in order, drive out the women between the domed house and the courtyard wall, and run your sword through them. Kill them all, and teach them to forget their secret bussing and cuddling with these brave gallants. The women now came in with dreadful wailing and floods of tears. First they had to carry out the dead bodies and lay them along the courtyard wall, packed close together under the gallery. Odysseus gave them directions and let them waste no time. They had to obey. Then they cleaned up the tables and seats with sponges and water. Telemachus and the two men scraped over the floor with shovels, and the women cleared out the scrapings. When the great hall was quite in order, they drove the women outside and cooped them up in a narrow space between the domed house and the wall, so that they could not get out. Telemachus had been thinking, and now he said, I should not care to give a clean death to these women, who have heaped insults on my head and upon my mother, and slept by the side of those who pretended to her hand. So he rigged up a ship's hawser, fastening one end to a tall pillar and throwing the other round the dome. A noose was looped round the neck of each, and he pulled it up tight so that their feet would not touch the ground. They were strung up with their heads in a row, a pitiable death to die, no lover's bed indeed. They looked like a lot of thrushes or doves caught in a net when they come to roost in the bushes. Their feet jerked for a little while, but not long. Melanthius was brought out by the forehall and courtyard. His nose and ears and cods were cut off and thrown to the dogs to eat raw. Then hands and feet were cut off to vent their fury. The work was done. They washed their hands and feet and went into the great house. Then Odysseus called his nurse Eurycleia and said, Bring sulphur and fire to cleanse the hall and sweeten the air. Then request Penelopea to come here with her waiting women, and tell all the other women in the house to come. Nurse Eurycleia answered, Aye, my love, there's not to miss with that, but let me fetch thee some clean clothes. Don't stand there with that bundle of rags on thy broad shoulders. That would be a real shame. Odysseus said, First of all, get the fire lighted. The nurse obediently brought fire and sulphur, and Odysseus smoked the hall well with it, and the forehall, and the courtyard. Then the old woman went into the house to tell the women to make haste and come, and they came from their quarters, torch in hand. How they crowded about Odysseus, throwing their arms round him, and giving him welcome, and kissing his head and shoulders, and holding his hands. He longed to relieve his feelings with tears, for in his heart he knew them all. Book 23. How Odysseus Found His Wife Again. Away went the old woman with her news that the master was in the house. She climbed the stairs, chuckling to herself. Her knees trotted along, her feet tumbled over each other. She leant down over her mistress and said, Wake up, dear love, wake up, Penelopea. Come and see with thy own eyes what thou'st prayed for many a long day. The master has come. He's in the house, better late than never, and he's killed the whole lot of Camarimiquicks who have made themselves a nuisance and eaten thy victuals and plagued thy boy. Penelopea was too cautious to believe this. She replied, Nanny, dear, the gods have made you mad.
They can make the wisest of men foolish, and they can give good sense to the weakest mind. They have upset even you, and you are generally sound enough. Why do you mock me? I have trouble as it is, and here you come to tell me this crazy tale, and wake me out of a lovely sleep when my poor eyes were fast closed. I have not had such a sleep since Odysseus went on his voyage to Ilion, the accursed, which I cannot endure to name. Go away, do, and get back to your room. If any of my other women had waked me up and told me this tale, I should have sent her off in disgrace. But your age shall protect you. The old woman answered, I don't mock them. I love 'tis the truth. The master has come. He's in the house, as I say. That stranger man, the one they all sneered at in hall. Telemachus knew that he was here, so it turned out, but he's a prudent one, hid his father's notions. Punish the men who were above themselves. Make them pay for their violence. That was his mind. How glad was Penelope! She sprang out of bed and flung her arms round the old woman's neck. The tears ran down her cheeks, and her words were plain enough now. Tell me, Nanny dear, tell me truly, if he is really come home, as you say, how did he get his hands on those shameless men alone by himself, and they in a crowd together as they always were? The old woman replied, I saw naught, and I axed naught, only I heard a noise while they were being killed. We got all as far away as we could, and sat in the corners, and kept the doors locked, scared out of our wits, till thy son called me out of the room. His father wanted me, says he. Then I found the master standing in the middle of the corpses. They were all around him, covering the solid ground in heaps. It would have warmed thy heart to see it. Now they're all packed together by the courtyard gates, and he's fuming the hall with sulphur and the great big fire blazing, but he sent me to tell thee. Come now, enter into your heart's delight, come be happy together after all your troubles. Now at last the prayer is answered that was prayed so long. He is alive. He has come himself to his own hearth. He has found thee also and his son in the house, and he has taken vengeance in his own house on all the men who did him wrong. Penelope said again, Nanny dear, don't boast too soon with all that gloating and chuckling. You know how glad we should all be to see him in this house, especially myself and my son. But there is no truth in your story. No, no, it is one of the immortal gods who killed these proud men. He must have been shocked by their heartbreaking violence and evil doings, for they respected no man on earth that ever met them, good or bad, and therefore they have been punished for their recklessness. But Odysseus has lost his hope of return far away from this land. He has lost himself. The old nurse answered,
My dear love, what a screed to let out of thy pretty lips. Here's thy man in the house, by the hearthstone, and thou'lt have it, he'll never come back home. But thy mind was ever unbelieving. Look now, I'll give thee a plain, manifest sign. The wound that the boar gave him with his tusk, I felt it in the washing, and wanted to tell thee, but a clips me over the mouth and won't let me utter a word.
He's a clever one, a deep mind assuredly has.
Come along, I'll lay my life on it. If I deceive thee, burn me alive and welcome.
Penelope, still doubtful, replied, Nanny, dear, it is hard to understand the counsels of the immortal gods, even if you are a very wise woman. However, let us go to my son. I should like to see the men who plagued me, and the man who slew them.
Saying this, she went down the stairs with a heart full of perplexity. Should she keep aloof and question her husband? Should she go to his side and cover head and hands with her kisses? She passed over the great doorstone into the hall and seated herself opposite to Odysseus by the wall on one side of the bright fire. He was sitting against a pillar looking down and wondering whether his brave wife would speak to him when she saw him. But she sat silent a long time, as if struck dumb. Again and again she turned her eager eyes and looked hard at his face. But then again she could not know him in those dirty rags. At last Telemachus burst out impatiently, "My mother! A devil of a mother you are, with your hard heart. Why do you keep
all that way from father? Why won't you sit beside him and ask some question or say something? I'm sure no other woman could be so cold and keep her husband at a distance now he has come home after 20 years and all those terrible dangers. But your heart was always harder than flint."
Penelope, still doubtful, answered,
"My boy, my heart is numbed. I cannot speak to him or ask questions or look into his face. If he is indeed Odysseus, and this is his house, we shall know each other well enough. There are secrets that we too know, and no one else."
Odysseus smiled at this. He answered at once, simply and plainly, "Leave your mother alone, Telemachus, and let her test me. She will soon know me better. Now I am ragged and dirty. She looks down on me and thinks I am not the man. But we have to consider what is best to do next. If you take the life of one man in the community, and he has a number of friends to avenge him afterwards, you must leave your country to escape his kinsmen. But we have destroyed the bulwark of the city, the finest lads in Ithaca. Consider that, if you please." Telemachus said with due respect, "You see to that, dear father. You have your plans ready for everything, as all the world declares, and no man living could challenge you in that." Odysseus was quite ready and replied, "Very well, I will say what I think best. First, wash from head to foot and put on clean clothes, and tell the household women to dress. Let the minstrel take his harp and strike up a cheerful dance, so that the neighbors and those in the street outside may hear it and think there is a wedding. No rumor must go abroad that these men are killed until we can get out to the farms and the forests. After that we will consider any plan that the Olympian may put into our minds." They set about this at once. They bathed and dressed, and the women decked themselves out. The minstrel took up his harp and put them in the mood for merry dance and song. The great hall echoed to the dancing feet of women and men, and those passing by in the street said one to another,
"Ha! Someone has married the much-wooed lady. She's a hard one. She didn't break her heart for the husband of her youth. She might have looked after the house till he came back."
They little knew what had happened. Within that house Eurynome bathed Odysseus and rubbed him down and gave him good clothes. Then he seemed another man, taller and stronger than before, and splendid from head to foot by grace of Athena. His head covered with a thick curly crop like the thick clustering petals of the hyacinth. He was a noble and brilliant figure. You might think of some perfect work of art made by one who is inspired by the divine artists, Hephaestus and Pallas Athena, brilliant with gold over silver. He came out of the bathroom looking more like a god than a man, and returned to his former seat, facing his wife. Then he said to her, "Strange woman, the inscrutable will of God has made your heart unfeeling beyond mortal women. No other wife could endure to keep her husband at a distance when he has just returned after 20 years of dreadful perils. Very well, come, Nanny. Lay me a bed, and I will sleep alone. She has a heart of steel, it is clear." His clever wife replied,
"Strange man, I am not proud or contemptuous or offended, but I know what manner of man you were when you sailed away from Ithaca. Come, Eurycleia, make the bed outside the room which he built himself. Put the fine bedstead outside, and lay out the rugs and blankets and fleeces."
This was a little trap for her husband.
He burst into a rage. "Wife, that has cut me to the heart. Who has moved my bed? That would be a difficult job for the best workman, unless God himself should come down and move it. It would be easy for God, but no man could easily prize it up, not the strongest man living. There is a great secret in that bed. I made it myself, and no one else touched it. There was a strong young olive tree in full leaf, growing in an enclosure, the trunk as thick as a pillar. Round this I built our bridal chamber.
I did the whole thing myself, laid the stones and built a good roof over it, jointed the doors and fitted them in their places. After that, I cut off the branches and trimmed the trunk from the root up, smoothed it carefully with the adze, and made it straight to the line. This tree I made the bedpost. That was the beginning of my bed. I bored holes through it and fitted the other posts about it and inlaid the framework with gold and silver and ivory, and I ran through it leather straps colored purple. Now I have told you my secret, and I don't know if it is still there, wife, or if someone has cut the olive at the root and moved my bed. She was conquered. She could hold out no longer when Odysseus told the secret she knew so well. She burst into tears and ran straight to him, throwing her arms about his neck. She kissed his head and cried, "Don't be cross with me, my husband. You were always a most understanding man. The gods brought affliction upon us because they grudged us the joy of being young and growing old together. Don't be angry, don't be hurt because I did not take you in my arms as soon as I saw you. My heart has been frozen all this time with a fear that someone would come and deceive me with a false tale. There were so many impostors. But now you have told me the secret of our bed. That settles it. No one else has seen it, only you and I and my maid, Actoris, the one my father gave me when I came to you, who used to keep the door of our room. You have convinced your hard-hearted wife." Odysseus was even more deeply moved, and his tears ran as he held her in his arms, the wife of his heart, so faithful and so wise. She felt like a shipwrecked mariner when the stout ship has been driven before the storm and smashed by the heavy waves, but a few have escaped by swimming. How glad they are to see land at last, to get out of the water and stand upon solid ground, all caked with brine. So glad was Penelope to see her husband at last. She held her white arms close round his neck and could not let him go. Dawn would have risen upon their tears of joy, but Athena had a thought for them. She held the night in its course and made it long. She kept Dawn on her golden throne at the end of ocean, so that she could not yoke up her swift pair, Flasher and Flamer, the colts who bring Dawn with her light to mortal men. At last Odysseus said to his wife, "Dear wife, we have not yet reached the end of our labors. There still remains a task which I cannot measure, difficult and dangerous, but I must go through to the end. The soul of Tiresias, the prophet, told me on the day when I went to the house of Hades and asked his advice for our homeward voyage. But come to our bed, my wife, that we may have the delight of sleeping side by side." Penelope replied, "The bed is there for you whenever you please, now that God has brought you back to your home and your native land. But since you have thought of it, tell me about this task. I must learn of it some time, and I should rather like to know at once." Odysseus answered, "You strange woman, why do you make me go on talking again? All right, I'll tell you and hide nothing. You'll not like it, nor do I like it myself. He told me to visit city after city, carrying an oar, until I should find people who do not know the sea, or eat salt with their food. Know nothing, said he, about ships with crimson cheeks, and well-fashioned oars which are like the ship's wing feathers. Then he told me this, for a clear sign, and I tell it to you. Whenever someone should meet me on the road and say I had a winnowing shovel on my shoulder, I should fix my oar at once in the ground, then sacrifice to Lord Poseidon in due form a bull, a ram, and a boar pig. And then, on returning home, I was to prepare a solemn sacrifice in turn to all the gods who rule the broad heavens. I am to live myself with my people, happy around me, until I sink under the comfortable burden of years and death. Will just come to me gently from the sea. That is what will happen according to him." Penelope answered with her usual good sense, "Well, if the gods are to give you such a comfortable burden of old age, there's good hope that you will come safely through your other trials." Meanwhile, Eurynome and the old nurse laid the soft bedding under the torchlight. When all was ready, the old nurse went to rest in her own room, and Eurynome attended them, torch in hand, to their chamber, and left them there. With happy hearts they came to the place where their old bed was, and Telemachus, with the drover and the swineherd, ended their dance, and sent the women away, and went to rest. Now all the house was dark, and these two enjoyed at last the blessing of love. Then they had a delightful talk of the past. She described what she had gone through, how she had to look on while that wasteful gang slaughtered all those cattle and sheep and emptied all those butts of wine on her account. Odysseus told what hardships he had endured and what trouble he had brought on others. The story delighted his wife, and she could not close her eyes till she had heard it all. He began with the Ciconian battles, and went on to the Lotus-eater's country, and what the Cyclops did, and how he avenged those fine fellows whom the cannibal devoured without pity. The visit of Aeolus, how kindly he had received them and helped them on their voyage. But it was not yet his destiny to reach home. The tempest caught him up again and drove him over the sea in distress. Then how he came to Laestrygonian Telepolis, and the natives destroyed the ships and their crews. He told of Circe's tricks and devices, and how he sailed to the mouldering house of Hades to consult the soul of Theban Tiresias, how he saw his old comrades, and the mother who had borne him and brought him up, how he heard the throbbing notes of the siren's song, how he went on to the moving rocks and dread Charybdis and Scylla, whom no man ever escaped unharmed. How his companion slaughtered the sun's cattle, how Zeus, thundering in the heights, struck the ship with a fiery bolt, and his companions were destroyed, every one. How he alone escaped and came to Ogygia and the nymph Calypso. How she kept him in her cave and wanted to have him for a husband. How she cared for him and promised to make him immortal, never to grow old. But he would never consent. How, after great hardships, he reached the Phaeacians, and they treated him with right royal kindness, and conveyed him to Ithaca in one of their ships, with a heap of gifts, bronze and gold and fine woven stuffs. This was the end of his tale, for then sleep pounced upon them, sleep that soothes the heavy limbs and the heavy heart. Now came Athena's turn. When she thought Odysseus had slept long enough by his wife's side, she released golden dawn from Oceanus to bring light to mortal men. Odysseus rose from his soft bed and said, "My wife, we have had trials enough already, both of us, you mourning and watching for my return, and I held fast by Zeus and all the gods far from the home I craved, and at last we are both in our own bed, which we have so long desired. Now you must take care of the house and what is in it, and I must replace what has been wasted and destroyed. The people will repay part, and the rest I'll take by force until my pens are full again. But first I will pay a visit to the woodlands and the farm, to see my good father who is troubled on my account. I warn you to be careful, although you're wise enough to understand without that. As soon as the sun rises, everyone will hear about the men I have killed in this house. You must keep in your apartments with your women, see no one, and ask no questions." He put on his body armor, then wakened Telemachus and the two men and made them do the same. When they were all ready with their weapons in their hands, they opened the gates, and Odysseus led them out. It was already light, but Athena hid them in darkness, and quickly led them out of the town. Book 24. How Odysseus Found His Old Father, and How the Story Ended. Cyllenian Hermes came to summon the souls of the dead men. He held the rod of fine gold, with which he enchants the eyes of men, if he will, or awakes those who sleep. With this he stirred them, and they followed, gibbering. They were like a swarm of bats in the hollows of a great cave, which hang clinging to one another from the roof until one falls out of the chain, and they all fly about gibbering in confusion. So Hermes, the master trickster, led them along the mouldering road, and they gibbered as they went. Past the stream of ocean they went, past the rock of Lucas, past the gates of the sun and the realm of dreams, and then they came to the meadow of Asphodel, where abide the souls and phantoms of those whose work is done. There they found the soul of Achilles, Pelides, and Patroclus, and the admirable Antilochus, and Aias, noblest and handsomest of the Danaan host after peerless Achilles. These were standing together, and the soul of Agamemnon Atrides joined them, grieving, with the others who had been killed beside him in Aegisthus' house. Achilles first addressed him thus, "Prince of the house of Atreus, we always thought you the nearest and dearest of heroes and men to thundering Zeus, for you ruled over a host of mighty men in that terrible war before Troy. And yet it seems you were doomed to perish before your time, although death comes to every man who is born. Would that you had met your fate before Troy, still enjoying that honorable state of royalty. Then the whole Achaean nation would have built you a tomb to keep a glorious memory of you and your son both. But it seems you were destined to die a most pitiable death." The soul of Atrides answered, "You are happy, royal prince of the house of Peleus, that you died at Troy, far from Argos, in the battlefield, with friend and foe falling on every side, fighting for your cause. There you lay in the whirling dust, grand in death, as once grand in life, forgetful of your horsemanship. But we fought the whole day long, and never would have ended the fight, but that Zeus made an end with a tempest. We carried you off the field and laid you upon a bier. We washed your body with warm water and anointed it with oil. Hot tears were shed from many eyes, and the hair was cut from all heads. Your mother came out of the sea with the immortal daughters of the sea when the tidings reached her. Their loud lamentations resounded over the deep, and trembling took hold of all the Achaean host. They would have leapt up and taken to their ships, had not a wise old man restrained them. Nestor, whose counsel had proved the best many a time before, he spoke to them gently and kindly, 'Back, men of Argos, do not run, brave lads of Achaea. His mother has come out of the sea with the immortal daughters of the sea to visit her dead son.' The Achaeans took heart and stayed their flight. Round about your body stood the daughters of the old man of the sea, wailing lamentably, and clothed in unfading raiment, incorruptible. The nine muses sang the dirge with their lovely voices, answering each to each in turn. You could not have seen one tearless eye in the host, when all were so deeply moved by that sweet song. 17 days and 17 nights we mourned you, mortal men and immortal gods, together. On the 18th day we gave you to the fire and slew around you fatted cattle and sheep. You were burnt in raiment of the gods with honey and oil in abundance. Troops of armed warriors marched round the pyre, both horse and footman, with a loud resounding noise. And when the fierce flame had consumed you, next morning we gathered up your whitened bones and laid them with pure wine and oil in a golden urn which your mother gave us. She said it was the work of famous Hephaestus, and a gift from Dionysus. In that urn lie your bones, Achilles, mingled with the bones of Patroclus, your dear friend. In another, the bones of Antilochus, whom you honored above all others after Patroclus died. Then all our armed host built for these three a great and notable tomb on a headland of the coast above the wide Hellespont, to be seen from the sea afar by men who now live and those who shall come after. Your mother gathered fine prizes from the gods and set them up for a contest of the best men. Often enough you have been at the funeral games of the great when a king has died, and strong young men gird themselves for the prize. But had you seen those prizes, the beautiful prizes which Silverfoot Thetis had provided, you would have marveled indeed, for the gods loved you dearly.
And so, although you are dead, your name is not forgotten, Achilles, but it will be renowned forever throughout all the world. But as for me, what pleasure have I in this that I wound up the war? For at my return Zeus had ready for me a cruel death at the hands of Aegisthus and my accursed wife. While they were conversing, King's messenger Argifontes drew near, leading the souls of those whom Odysseus had killed. The two princes moved towards them, surprised at this sight. Then the soul of King Agamemnon recognized Amphimedon, who had entertained him in Ithaca. He said at once,
"Amphimedon, what disaster has brought you here under the black earth, all picked men and years' mates? If one were to choose the best men of your city, he could make no other choice. Did Poseidon raise a wild storm and a heavy sea and swamp your ships? Did the enemy fall on you ashore while you were cutting out cattle and sheep? Or were they fighting before their walls for their wives and homes? Answer me, for you are my host and friend. Do you not remember how I came to your house to enlist Odysseus in the war of Menelaus against Ilion? It took us a whole month to cross the broad sea, and it was a hard task to persuade Odysseus, who brought us victory in the end."
The soul of Amphimedon answered, "I remember all that quite well, royal prince. I will tell you the miserable story of our death as it happened. Odysseus had been long absent, and we were wooing his wife. She hated the thought of marriage, but she would not refuse outright or make an end of the business, because she was planning death and destruction for us. Here is one scheme which came out of her meditations. She set up a great wide web on her loom, and fine stuff it was, and she said to us, 'You lads who seek my hand, now that Odysseus is dead, I know you chafe at the delay, but give me time to finish this piece of cloth. I don't want to waste the thread. It is to be a shroud for Laertes, when all-destroying fate shall carry him off in dolorous death. I do not wish all the women to be shocked if he lies without a shroud, when he had been lord of great possessions.' Our proud hearts consented. Then she used to work at her great web in the daylight, and unraveled it at night by torchlight. Thus for 3 years she managed to deceive the whole nation. But when the seasons came round again in the 4th year, one of her women, who was in the secret, told us, and we caught her unravelling that fine web. So she had to finish it, much against her will. And when she took down her web and washed it and showed it to us, shining like the sun or the moon, then some devil of a god brought Odysseus from somewhere, and put him on Land's End where the swineherd had his place. Then back comes his son from Pylos over the sea, and the two together make their plan for our death. First Telemachus came back to town, then the swineherd brought Odysseus, clothed in rags and leaning upon a staff like some old beggar. There he was, a disgusting sight. And none of us could know who he was, not even the older men. But we received him with rude blows and words, and he puts up with the rude blows and words in his own house, bides his time, if you please, until Zeus Almighty set him to work. Then he and Telemachus carried off all the armor and weapons and locked them up in the storehouse, and the cunning schemer told his wife to bring out the bow and iron axes and propose a contest, which was the beginning of our unfortunate death. None of us could bend the great bow and string it. We were far too weak. But when the bow was on its way to Odysseus, we all shouted out not to give it, whatever he said. Only Telemachus would have it so. Then Odysseus received the bow. He strung it easily and shot through the axe heads, went and stood in the doorway and spread the arrows before his feet, glaring terribly, then shot Antinous. After that he took aim at the others in turn and shot them down with those arrows of sorrow, and they fell one after another. It was clear that some god helped them, for they now rushed along the hall, furiously striking right and left. Hideous cries and groans came as the heads were smashed, and all the ground ran with blood. That is how we perished, Agamemnon, and our bodies are still lying uncared for in the great house of Odysseus. Our friends do not know yet.
They have not yet come to wash the blood from the wounds and lay out the bodies for mourning, which is the honor due unto the dead.
The soul of Agamemnon answered, Happy Odysseus, always ready for every danger. What a wife you have won, with a dower of noble gifts. What a true heart and keen intelligence has the incomparable Penelope. How well she remembered the husband of her youth. The fame of her virtue shall never be forgot, and the immortals will make upon the earth a lovely song for faithful Penelope.
How different she is from the daughter of Tyndareus, who concocted a vile plot and murdered the husband of her youth. What a hateful song will be sung of her among men, and she will bring an evil name upon all women, even such as are good.
So they conversed in the house of Hades, in the caverns under the earth. Meanwhile the others passed through the city, and soon came to the snug farm of Laertes, which he had made his own by his own hard work. There was his house, and there were sheds all round in which the serfs lived, and fed, and slept, and did what he wanted. Among them was an old Sicilian woman, who looked after the old man carefully when he was in the country. Here Odysseus gave his directions to the serfs and Telemachus.
Go indoors, all of you, he said, and kill the best pig for our dinner. I'm going to try if my father will know me when he sees me, or if I have been away too long for that.
Then he handed his arms to the serfs, and they went indoors. Odysseus passed on to the vineyard to make inquiries. He did not find Dolius as he went down into the enclosure, nor any of his sons or underlings, for they had all gone out with the old man to collect stones for a wall round the vineyard. So he found his father alone in the vineyard, digging about one of the plants. He had on him a dirty old shirt full of patches, with patched leather gaiters to save his shins from scratches, and leather gauntlets against the brambles. On his head he wore a goatskin hat in the carelessness of his sorrow. When Odysseus saw him, at last, worn with age and full of sorrow, he stood still under a spreading pear tree, and the tears came into his eyes. What should he do? Should he throw his arms around the old man and kiss him and tell the whole story of his return? Or should he first question him and see what he would say? On the whole, it seemed better to try a few words of pleasantry, so he came near. The old man was stooping down and digging about one of the plants when his son stepped beside him and said,
"Well done, Gaffer. I see you know how to look after an orchard. It is in fine order, and there is not a single tree or plant neglected in the whole place, not a fig tree, not a vine, not an olive, not a pear, not a herb or vegetable. But don't be offended if I dare to say you are not so well looked after yourself. Old age is bad enough, but you are all over dirt, and your clothes are no credit to you. If your master neglects you, he can't say you are an idler. But there is nothing of the slave in your looks. You are more like one of the quality, more like one who would have a bath and a good dinner and soft sleep, as an old man ought to have. Tell me now, just to satisfy my curiosity, who is your master? Whose orchard is this? There is something else, too, I want to know. Is this really Ithaca, as that fellow I met just now said it was? He didn't seem to be quite all there, wouldn't answer questions, or listen to what I had to say when I inquired about my old friend, whether he is still in the land of the living, or dead and buried. I tell you this, and don't make any mistake about it. There was a man whom I entertained in my own country. He came to our house, and there never was a foreigner who was more welcome to my house, said he belonged to Ithaca, said his father was Laertes Arcisiades. I took him into my house and treated him handsomely, entertainment of the best, the fat of the land, gave him such gifts as a guest ought to have, 7 talents weight of wrought gold I gave him, and a bowl of solid silver with flowers all around. 12 sheets, 12 blankets, 12 fine robes and tunics to match, not to mention 4 women, as clever as you like with their fingers, and good-looking, too, at his own choice. His father answered
with tears.
"Stranger, that is the man whose country you have reached today. But now violent and riotous men possess it, and so you have wasted all that heap of gifts which you gave him. If you had found him alive in Ithaca, he would have made a good return for your generous gifts and entertained you as handsomely. Quite right, too, when one has a debt to repay. But pray tell me this and satisfy my curiosity. How long is it since that unhappy man was your guest? My own son, as indeed he was, poor fellow. Ah, the fishes have devoured him somewhere in the deep sea, or he has been the prey of beasts and birds on the land, far from home and friends. His mother and father did not lay him out and lament him, their own son, nor his precious wife, the true-hearted Penelopea. She did not close his eyes on the bier, her own husband, and lift up her voice in sorrow, as she ought to do, as a last honour for the dead. But there is something else I want to know. Who are you, and what country do you come from? Where does the ship ride which brought you here with your honourable companions? Perhaps it was not your own ship? You are a merchant and a passenger, and they just left you here?
Odysseus answered, "Very well, I will satisfy your curiosity. I come from Wonderland, where I have a great estate, and I am the son of Lord Neverstint Griefenpain. My name is Battledown. Ill luck beat me out of my course from Sicania, and brought me here against my will. My ship lies off the farm in some way from the city, and this is the 5th year since Odysseus left my home and country. Unhappy man. Yet, indeed, there were good birds for him when he went, on the right hand, which made me glad to speed him on his way, and made him glad to go. Both our hearts hoped that we should meet again in friendship and give each other splendid gifts." When he had spoken, a black cloud of sorrow came over the old man. With both hands he scraped up the grimy dust and poured it over his white head, sobbing. The son's heart was wrung, and bitter passion pressed through his nostrils as he looked upon his dear father. He made one spring at him and threw his arms around the old man and kissed him, crying out, "Here he is himself, my father. I am the man you are looking for. After 20 years I have returned to my native land. Weep no more, grieve no more, for I have news, and there is need of haste, sure enough. I have killed the men who sought my wife in my own house, and paid them in full for their violence and outrageous deeds."
Laertes answered, "If you are really Odysseus, my son, come home again. Give me a clear sign to prove that you speak the truth."
Odysseus said, "That wound, first of all, look, here it is for you to see. You remember how the boar gashed me with his tusk as I ran on him? You and my mother sent me to her father, Autolycus, to receive the gifts which he promised me when he stayed with us. Yes, and let me tell you, the trees you gave me in this jolly orchard when I was a little boy and went round the garden with you and begged for each. We walked among these very trees. You told me their names, every one. 13 pear trees you gave me, and 10 apples, 40 figs, rows of vines you promised, 50 of them bearing at different times through the vintage, with grapes of all sorts, whenever Zeus made them heavy in the season of the year."
The old man's knees crickled under him, and his heart melted as he heard the signs recounted which he knew so well. He laid his arms about his son's neck, and Odysseus held him, fainting. But when he had recovered and come to himself once more, he spoke and said,
"Oh, Father Zeus, verily ye gods are still abiding in broad Olympus, if indeed these evil men have paid for their violence. But now I am terribly afraid that soon all Ithaca will be here in force, and they may send summons to the Cephallenian cities."
But Odysseus answered, "Courage, let not that thought trouble you. But now let us return to your house near the orchard. I sent Telemachus ahead with the drover and swineherd to get dinner for us as soon as they could." They set out at once for the homestead, and there they found Telemachus and the two men carving the meat and mixing the wine.
Then the old woman bathed Laertes and rubbed him down with soft oil and wrapped a fine robe about him. Athena stood by his side and put fullness into his limbs, so that he seemed stronger and bigger than before. When he came out of the bathroom, his son was astonished to see him like one come down from heaven, and he said in plain words, "My father, surely one of the immortal gods has made a new man of you, taller and stronger than I saw you before." Laertes answered full of spirit, "Ah, by Zeus and Athena and Apollo, if I were the man I was when I took Nericon, that strong fortress on the shore of the mainland, when I was lord of the Cephallenians, and if I had been yesterday by your side with armor on my shoulders to fight with those riotous men, many a one would I have killed and made your heart glad." While they were speaking, the three had finished their task. The meal was ready, and they seated themselves about it. As they were about to set to, in came old Dolius with his sons, tired after their work, for their mother had run out in good time to fetch them. That is, the old Sicilian woman who used to look after Laertes so carefully now that he was old. As soon as they saw Odysseus and knew him, they stood there amazed. But Odysseus spoke kindly to them and said, "Sit down, gaffer, and don't be astonished. We have been waiting a long time for you, as hungry as we can be." But Dolius ran straight to him with open arms and caught the wrist of Odysseus, kissing him and crying, "Oh, my dear master, so you have come back when we never hoped to see you again. God himself brought you. Bless you and save you, and may God grant you every happiness. Tell me, does my lady know that you have returned, or shall we send a message?" Odysseus answered, "She knows already, gaffer. You need not trouble for that." On hearing this, the old man sat down again, and his sons, like him, welcomed Odysseus with word and hand, and seated themselves by their father. While they were busy with their meal, rumor sped all over the city with the news, telling how the pretenders had come to a miserable end. The people, on hearing this, gathered from all quarters before the house of Odysseus with groanings and loud uproar. Each family took their own dead and carried them home for burial. Those who came from abroad they sent away in the charge of seamen, each to his own city. Then they held a meeting of the whole town, and crowded into the marketplace, sorrowing. Eupeithes first rose to address them, full of indignation and sorrow for his son Antinous, whom Odysseus had brought down with the first shot. With tears rolling down his cheeks for his son, Eupeithes said, "My friends, here is a monstrous thing this man has done against our nation. First he goes off with a fleet of ships and a lot of fine fellows, loses the ships, loses the men, and comes back alone. Then he kills the best of the Cephallenians. Come now, before he can escape to Pylos or Elis and the Epeans, let us move, or we shall be disgraced forever. It will be a blot upon us in generations to come if we do not punish the murderers of our sons and brothers. Life would be nothing to me. I would rather die at once and lie in my grave. Move, quickly, don't let them steal a march on us and get over the water." The people were all filled with pity to see his tears and to hear his words, but suddenly Medon and the minstrel appeared on the outskirts of the crowd. They had just waked up and come straight from the house, and there they were in the midst of them, to the amazement of all. Medon spoke up confidently and said, "Give me a hearing, men of Ithaca. The hand of God is in this. I saw myself an immortal god standing beside Odysseus and looking exactly like Mentor. An immortal god now in front of Odysseus and encouraging him, now sweeping through the hall to scare the ladies' wooers, and they fell in heaps." The listeners went pale with fear. Then spoke the old man Halitherses Masterides, who alone could see forward and backward, and he gave them wise advice. "Hear me, men of Ithaca, for I have something to say. Your own fault has brought this about. You would not listen to me nor to Prince Mentor when he warned you to restrain your sons from their folly. It is they who did the monstrous thing in the recklessness of their hearts, wasting the goods and dishonoring the wife of a nobleman, for they thought he would never return.
Then listen to me now and do as I say. Let us make no move, or someone may bring trouble on his own head."
This brought loud cries of applause, and more than half of those present sprang up from their seats. But the others sat still and kept together, for they did not approve the speech, but obeyed Monsignor Plausible. These very soon went away for arms and armor, and when they were ready they appeared before the city gate. Eupeithes took the lead, foolish man. He thought to avenge his son's death. But he was destined to find his own death, then and there, and never to return. Now Athena was watching, and she said to Zeus Cronion, "Cronides, almighty father of us all, let me ask you a question. What plan is hidden deep in your mind? Will you still contrive war upon war and battle upon battle, or will you make peace between these two parties?"
Zeus, cloud-gatherer, answered, "My dear child, why do you ask me such questions? Was not this the plan of your own mind, that Odysseus should come back and punish these men? Do as you like, but I will tell you what seems the right thing. Now that Odysseus has had his vengeance, let them make up the quarrel, and let him continue to be prince as before. But let us pacify the blood feud for these dead sons and brothers. Let them all be friends as before, and let peace and plenty abide with them."
This was just what Athena wanted to do. Away she went down from the peaks of Olympus. Meanwhile, Odysseus and his friends had finished their meal, and now he said,
"Someone go out and see if they are coming."
One of Dolius's sons went out of the door, and there he saw the whole body of men close at hand. He turned to Odysseus and said simply,
"Here they are, close by. Let us arm at once."
They were soon ready, four led by Odysseus and the six sons of Dolius. Laertes and Dolius, too, armed themselves, warriors perforce. Armed and ready, they issued forth from the door with Odysseus at their head. Then Athena came near, in the form of Mentor and with Mentor's voice. The sight made Odysseus glad, and he called to his son Telemachus,
"My son! Now you have come to the place of battle where the best men are proved. You will know how not to disgrace your father, since our line has been notable over all the earth for courage and valor."
Telemachus answered, "You shall see, if you will, my dear father, that my spirit shall bring no disgrace upon your line."
Laertes was full of joy and cried out, "What a day is this, kind gods! I am a happy man. My son and my son's son are rivals in courage."
Athena came near him and said,
"Old friend and dearest of all my comrades, pray to Father Zeus and his fierce-eyed girl. Poise your long spear and cast it now."
She breathed strong passion into him as she spoke. He uttered a prayer to the daughter of great Zeus, poised and cast his long spear, and struck Eupeithes in his helmet of bronze. Right through the morion it went, and the blade came out on the other side. Eupeithes fell in his armor with a crash. Then Odysseus and his brave son fell upon the foremost, and struck them with sword and spear. They would have made an end of them all on the spot, but Athena, daughter of Zeus Almighty, lifted her voice and stayed them all. "Stay your hands from battle, men of Ithaca. Be reconciled, and let bloodshed cease." They stood aghast, pale as death. At her voice the weapon slipped from their hands and fell on the ground. All turned and went back to the city, for they did not wish to die. Odysseus shouted loudly, and gathering himself together, he swooped on them like an eagle from the high heaven. But Zeus cast a blazing thunderbolt before the feet of Athena. Then the goddess said to Odysseus, "Odysseus Laertiades, prince never unready, hold your hand. Make an end of war and conflict, and fear the wrath of Zeus Cronides, who sees all things." Odysseus obeyed gladly with all his heart. After this, Pallas Athena, daughter of Zeus Almighty, in the likeness of Mentor and with Mentor's voice, made peace between both parties. and ended the strife forever. This concludes the reading of The Odyssey, the story of Odysseus, by Homer, translated by W.H.D. Rouse. This book was read by Anthony Heald. This unabridged recording was produced in 2008 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright there, too. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio. If you would like to obtain a complete catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.